My name is Mike Smith. The theme this week that I'm hoping that the various presentations I do are connected to is democracy and foreign policy. And I'd like to say a little bit about my interests in this, both in general and in the topic today. I'm interested in the question of democracy and foreign policy, I think, originally because during the Vietnam War, I remember hearing people say, if only this country were more democratic, we wouldn't be in this war, or we'd get ourselves out of it, or something or other, which I wasn't certain about that that was the case, but it did stimulate some interest. And then later on, maybe 5 or 10 years ago, I was reading some political science literature about foreign policy, and the people who study the making of foreign policy generally say, or at least they said at that time, that the kind of government you have doesn't make any difference, that it really doesn't matter very much what kind of government you have, you'll still have the same kind of foreign policy. And I guess, being obstinate or something, I was inclined to believe that probably it did make some kind of difference, that having a democracy instead of having another form of government would make some kind of difference. So I started trying to think about that, and that leads in some way to the topics I will be dealing with this week. The ones Tuesday through Saturday are topics, each of which it seems to me probably democracy does make some difference. And so that's the reason for those topics. Today I'm interested in the definition of democracy. It seems like a good place to start by defining democracy. And this interest goes back a long way. I've been troubled by problems of definition, and sometimes I feel like we shouldn't say that the United States is a democracy. It doesn't seem democratic. And at other times when we say it is, I don't know, that's troubling too. I think you'll see better in a moment why I find it troubling, but this is something I've not been able to resolve for myself. And I say that knowing that a whole lot of political scientists do not have this problem. They find one definition or another and they're satisfied with it and they go on, but I'm not so easily satisfied, and so I hope to share my problems with you today, and you may be able to help me, and I hope also to some extent illuminate democracy and maybe show some variations, some different kinds of democracy that you might find interesting and thought-provoking at least. I'd like to begin, then if I can find some chalk, by giving two definitions. Normally when we say talk about democracy, I begin in freshman courses by saying that a democracy is a country, a government where the people rule. It's ruled by the people. And then shortly after that, we distinguish two possibilities. And one possibility is direct democracy. Direct democracy is a form of government where the people assemble and collectively govern themselves. And this kind of government of direct democracy is then distinguished from indirect democracy. And an indirect democracy is a form of government where the people elect representatives who govern them, and the representatives presumably govern the people in their interest. So, in the people's interest, yes. So we talk about these two kinds of democracy, and I guess the first place to start is to ask if this distinction makes some sense to you. Does it make sense to distinguish direct and indirect democracy? You understand what we're saying there?
I understand. I can't think of very many cases of direct democracy.
Okay, well that's part of what I want to get at, is whether there are cases and whether we can have practical experience of it. And I want to connect that with another question, which I guess I'm inclined to get to first. My reaction when I look at this, and I might add that we substitute terms sometimes. We talk about direct democracy, we sometimes call it pure democracy. We have other names for it, or I think strong democracy sort of gets at that, or participatory democracy. Indirect democracy we call representative government, or we call it a republic. We have various names for that, and they seem to signify pretty much the same thing. They seem to be fairly interchangeable, although they may have a little different emphasis. Part of the thing that gets to me is the sense that direct democracy is better, that being democratic is good, and if being democratic is good, direct democracy is better than indirect democracy. And I guess I want to ask you that. Do you have that same kind of reaction? Larry's saying that there aren't many examples of direct democracy, but doesn't it seem like it would be good to have more, that this would be a good thing to do?
It's very possible, though. They size group of people.
Okay, size is often mentioned as a problem.
It's simple.
Well, Switzerland and its cantons has direct democracy, but it's small. It's a tiny country. I don't like the term indirect democracy because it suggests rule by the people indirectly. And it strikes me that the type of government form that we have, where it's majority take all, or plurality if there are more than two candidates, and with our systems of Senate, which is where representatives, someone in Maine has a lot more votes than someone in California, that you might call it a certain Republican form. I wouldn't call it democracy, unless it's a very impure form of democracy.
Well, this has been popular to call these things democracies.
Did you intentionally use the word policy?
I did, because the notion is that in a direct democracy, the people really make the laws for themselves.
I think law and policy are different. Are they different?
They are, and I have a lot of trouble distinguishing exactly how they're different here. How do you think they're different?
Well, I think they're, sometimes there's a policy underlying a law, and sometimes there isn't. A policy is, I suppose, a collective wisdom about what are the values that underlie and the objectives that underlie the law.
Okay.
And sometimes we do that, but a lot of times we don't. We make a law.
Okay. So you would be more comfortable with who decide laws, who make the laws. I'm perfectly comfortable with that. Right? These are roughshod definitions, really. Any other comments?
Yeah, one of the things I would ask in a direct democracy, as far as maybe in some small village community like in Maine or someplace like that, we might find a real example of direct democracy. But when you look at the numbers and people, and I think outside of an unusual case like that, I don't think it's very common to be practiced.
Okay. When we talk about this, a lot of times what we say is we refer back to the Greeks, and we say, well, the Greeks had direct democracy, so if only we could recreate the city-state. But then the people on the other side say, well, wait a minute, they had slaves, they had these aliens, these foreigners who couldn't vote, the women weren't allowed to have any say. So you have this fraction of the population, the males who were descendants of the people who presumably settled in that community, they were the citizens, and everyone else was a non-citizen. So, it was a direct democracy, but a very limited number of people counted as citizens.
No, I mean, when you say that, I mean, that's Switzerland, too.
Well, women can vote in Switzerland.
No, they can, yeah.
Well,
that's
very recent. There's even worse than that. In Switzerland, your primary citizenship is in the town of where your family is. So if you were over here, you can only vote over here. Mm-hmm. Unless they have a national election.
Which was the Greek thing also. Mm. You belonged to a particular community. So you couldn't move around. Your citizenship
is a stable order. It's a stable order.
It reinforces stability. There's a premium for that. Anyway, there are those kinds of ancient examples. There are, it seems to me, I spent a little bit of time in Botswana in the late 1960s. In Botswana, I think I was very fortunate because Botswana is a relatively, or at least at that time, was a relative, had a relatively democratic village society that was based around the notion that when there were issues that had to be resolved, the people in the community would come together and collectively talk about them. Now, the way they talked about them was that the chief talked first, and the chief talked, and then all the males in the village would talk, and there was some status order of the males in the village, and when all the males were done, then the women of the village were allowed to talk, or the youngsters. But still, the way they resolved conflicts was each person in turn would speak on the issue until everyone had spoken. And the hope was, by the time you'd gone through everyone, that whatever needed to be said had been said, and that in a sense you'd arrived at some kind of compromise that people were satisfied with. And if people weren't satisfied, then they had another chance to speak. And so they kept talking. It wasn't really a voting system, it was a talking. We talked until it's all talked out. But it did seem democratic in a way, indirectly democratic in a way. But again, this was very small villages. The village I was in had about 1,000 people in it. I spent about a month there. I saw one of these go on, and my impression is that the village was subdivided. So at least the issue I saw discussed, it was not the entire village, it was about 1/6 of the village came together. So that's a very small, that's 100 people or 150 people working something out. So the size problem still is present, but on the other hand, the example suggests to me that there may be more examples of direct democracy than we think of offhand.
What about a kibbutz?
I don't know about that. Can anyone speak to that?
My daughter was on one for a while, and she said that she was with a Christian group working with Israelis on the kibbutz, and she said that they would sit down and discuss and talk as a group. And she said the only thing she disliked about it was they were supposed to be part of the kibbutz, but because they were Christian, they were not included. And the kibbutz actually made decisions for them. But she said she could sit in and listen, and they discuss every policy, and once the policy was decided, they went out and did.
So for the citizens, the members
of that kibbutz,
then it appeared democratic, but went on.
Yes.
And again, it's a form of democracy, and I hadn't planned to emphasize this particularly, but a form that doesn't necessarily rely heavily on voting, but on the discussion and talking things through. The question I wanted to lead up to then is the size, is based on the size question, in a local community, can you have a direct democracy? And I would urge you to think about churches. I brought this question up in my church, and that's immediately what people started talking about, was church and church governance. So the local church governance is direct democracy possible? And at the same time, does it happen?
Could you ask a third question, and is it desirable?
Well, yeah.
I mean, we assume, but it's the contemporary myth that democracy is the best form of government. It's not popular to question that. But for most of human history, people wouldn't have believed that. And I happen to prefer democracy over other forms, but I'm part of of this culture. Empirically, it's hard to argue. I mean, if you pose it as an empirical question, is democracy better than other forms? And you don't do it on something like nation state, start with like churches. It might raise interesting questions.
Well, I'm open to that question because that's been part of the reason I keep coming back to these questions, is I'm not settled on that.
It's only desirable if you have a clear, well-founded, and consistent educational system, whether it's in the church or in the society. Because I don't care to have people making decisions or contributing to a decision if they don't know anything about it. I think that's pretty dangerous.
Okay, so you would want well-informed or well-educated people.
And it doesn't need to be formal necessarily, formally. You have X number of courses, but I count life experience in that as well, but ignorance is not a good basis for decision.
Okay.
Just to complicate things, I think defining it is increasingly difficult just because it is such a popular word. It isn't questioned. I mean, who doesn't call themselves democracies? We had the German Democratic Republic until it dissolved and became part of the Federal Republic.
We had
the Czech Republic, we had the Hungarian. I mean, all the socialist countries were all democracies.
They were people's democracies.
Yeah, and then you got one-party democracies and multi-party democracies, but they're all democracies.
Wouldn't more people be better educated in a direct democracy because they were entitled to a vote to discuss, whereas in the indirect, a representative will do whatever he wants anyway. But in a direct democracy, I better know what it's all about so I can participate.
Well, this was, at least in some circles, this idea was popular in the 60s, that you give people power and then they will become responsible. They will...
But I lived in Switzerland for a year and in a family, and the Swiss father who voted had to vote on such a range of issues. There was no way that he, as one person, also carrying out his career, could be informed on all of those things. And so that one of the curses of direct democracy is that it is those people who know the most or most or have the most to gain or lose that will can often push things, and the rest of it.
Yeah, you run into some of the same things you run into in representative democracies. Participation isn't uniform. Not everybody turns out, not everyone's informed, they don't care enough to participate, and the more participation that's demanded, I think the more of a problem you have.
It's not always just a matter of care to how much they don't care to put in the time. That's true for some people, but also in a complex society, there may not be the time, period. There's no way.
That's one of my frustrations, though, is that in our own democracy, our own country, is that, like in California where we live, every election is a big bunch of propositions come out, and they put out a book about a quarter inch thick, these kinds of propositions. And I usually try to wait until at least part of it anyway, at least get the summaries of it. And yet, you see bumper stickers, you know, vote no on 79, it's bad for you. And people do that, like even reading word one what it's about. And yet they cancel my vote, which I think is a more educated vote, and that's a real frustration.
And there's a strong sense that whichever side can mount the most expensive advertising campaign is likely to win.
Yeah. Especially there's a whole calculus about how much it costs to get a proposition to California.
Or defeat it.
Or defeat
it. Whichever it is.
It's almost always money. And the more you put into it, the more chances of success.
And again, I think part of the notion of having the propositions is it's closer to direct democracy. It's giving more power to people to make decisions.
Well, they should fight it tooth and nail, though.
Yeah, so
they don't want democracy.
But isn't this just another continuation 200 years later between the old Hamiltonian, Jeffersonian thing? Hamilton said that people are uneducated and mostly often wrong and stupid and will make the wrong decisions. Mm-hmm. And they should let superior people like the people obviously in this room make the decision.
So I would question you.
And Jefferson said, no,
even if they're not educated and they're playing with their shoes, the people will out.
Are we not sitting at the same table, professing the same question about the stupidity of people versus the elitism of us?
But I hear people expressing some concern here that for reasons of time and for other reasons that they're and just sheer numbers that direct democracy is not workable, which is a recurring problem.
Doesn't it become less workable as technology develops? Mm-hmm. Following up on what was said, that we don't know everything about everything.
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons you can say it's unworkable. I don't find that very exciting, thinking of all the reasons it can't work. But the complexity of the problems, which if that's a problem in Switzerland, it's every bit as much a problem here. The technological issues, it's very difficult. And how do you you know, if you say, well, we'd like to winnow in some way, we're going to restrict voting to the people who educated themselves on an issue. I mean, that has some appeal, but I don't know how in the world you'd ever do that in any justice system.
Well, Mike, doesn't it depend upon what the underlying understanding of democracy is? I mean, I think you could make a case that electronic technologies make possible higher levels of participation in a rather direct sort of way. Whether it's taken up a la Ross Perot or whatever, town meeting, electronic town meeting. But there's a kind of underlying assumption there that democracy is an individual voting his or her own self-interest as he or she understands it. And then levels of education, etc., are a factor. But what is really crucial is that I vote my perceived self-interest. And a lot of democracy or democratic theory has been posited on such a notion.
It's interest-based theory. Yeah.
So you could make the case that you could get higher levels of participation mm-hmm. now because you have greater capacities to tally that information, get that information out, act on that information.
There are people who have ideas of teledemocracy that we mm-hmm. can reserve cable channels or something and we'll have continuing debates on public issues and then you can vote yes or no on those issues. So there is that kind of notion now. Like we would be disconnected from that here. We would lose our franchise temporarily if you had that. I'm not real happy with that. What you're saying is certainly true. And I think it goes back a long way, the notion that part of the appeal of democracy is it gives people a chance to defend their interests. It is if the shoe, you know, who knows whether the shoe fits or the shoe pinches the person wearing the shoe. That you want the voter. If the voter's foolish enough to be swayed by billboards, then they may get pinched down the line and hopefully they'll recognize that happened to them. But you want to give people the opportunity to defend their interests, that it isn't fair if people aren't given that opportunity to look out for their own interests. There's something more, though. My definition, roughshod as it is, I have something else in it, and that's the assembly part. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that there's a real value in people getting together and talking to each other. It's a face-to-face interchange, which, if there is a conflict in the community, it gives you a chance, forces you to hear, at least be in the presence of people who have different points of view. And that's, I think we miss that a lot. We have some very homogeneous communities, and it's easy not to hear what someone else has to say or what they have to complain about.
I don't know what the term is, but even the notion that the sum of the interests, or that even if it's assembled collectively by some invisible hand, will come up with the best policy strikes me as another assumption that we operate with. It's a little like it's the economic argument moved into the political realm, which is you allow individual choice and maximizing self-interest, and that somehow will work out. Well, we know empirically that's not true with economics, and I don't see any reason why we should assume that it's true, therefore, in government.
There's a whole lot of political thinking that is influenced by economic models. Mm-hmm. Political theorists are enamored of that economic kind of thinking. I think the clearest examples of what you are saying are cases of minorities dealing with majorities. And the minority may be outvoted, the preferences of the majority may be accumulated in some way, and the minority's interests are just ignored. And it seems to me hard to get around that in any easy way. But I want to come back to a moment to this idea of people assembling and the notion of face-to-face discussion, because, as I say, I think that's one of the values. When I was in Botswana, that was one of the things people had to deal with when they were in the community making a decision, was they had to listen to each other. because they had to, if you're trying to persuade people, you have to respond to what that other person has had to say, and you have to listen to what they say. And you hope that there are reasonable people in the audience who weigh one and weigh the other and come to some sensible conclusion out of the thing. And especially if there's pressure to arrive at consensus, then that's, I guess, puts even more limits on what happens in those kinds of things. I asked a moment ago about churches, because I wonder in church governance whether you have experienced something that approximates direct democracy or not.
There's still any representatives that we have, though.
We still have a council or whatever.
We meet twice a year at the General Assembly, and in between that, though, we have a board, church board that decides issues within certain parameters of constitutional violence.
Yeah. Would you say that the members of the church have a fair amount of say about what goes on in the church?
We're talking about the individual congregation or the institution?
I'm really talking about individual congregations. Okay. At that level.
Well, the turnout is never that good. I'll admit that. Maybe a fourth or a fifth of the membership turns out.
Well, because it's a homogeneous kind of a grouping of people. If you had conflicting interests, severely conflicting interests, you'd get a better turnout.
Yeah, when they're real,
hot coffee coming up, isn't it?
I guess I'm implying Lutherans don't value their churches as much as Baptists, maybe. But if you have more turnout for meetings and more contention,
I couldn't speak to that. If you're unhappy with the minister, you go directly to the meeting and you present a petition to fire him this week. And it has happened over the period of time. This has happened, you know, three or four times. And then they are out in the business of scurrying around to try and get temps and then convince somebody else to go into their pocket. You know.
I think that sometimes we have difficulty in our church getting members to participate on the church council. I think because of the conflict that everybody has their own special interest that's going. I just served my 3 years in hell. You know, I've got credit there. I go there. But trying to get somebody to replace that and going around and talking to members of the congregation, it's really been difficult because of the special interest in the conflict. And I don't think that we're really that democratic or as direct. Until you come to the General Assembly, and then that may end up, we've even, you know, well, I think I'll bring my attorney type of thing. Maybe other churches that aren't little experience has been, I think, more to that level.
Okay, you remind me of a conflict. This is a very minor conflict in our church that I discovered I guess I was probably aware of it before, but really became aware of it a few weeks ago, which was we built an education wing, and there was a question about what will be done in various rooms in this new wing, and the pastor was of the mind that, well, one of the rooms would be given to the junior high school kids, and they could decorate it as they wanted and so forth. Well, most of the members of the council felt like it's our new building, and those kids may do something crazy if we let them go in and just decorate it any which way. And this issue has festered all year with no communication and with resentment building and feeling those people are unreasonable, no, those people are unreasonable, I'm not talking it out. It strikes me there may be enough structure with the council or whatever the reason your comments reminded me of this is that the I'm not originally Lutheran, so I don't know all the titles. But
what president, were you?
President of the council?
Now, what were you?
Originally, I was Episcopalian, which is even more hierarchical, I believe. But who is the head of the council? Is the
president
of the council? Anyway, he was miserable with this issue, and very, you know, felt like he got criticized all the time. Express sort of the same kind of your sense. Is that commonplace? you have a system that is somewhat democratic, maybe fairly democratic. It's an opportunity for direct local government.
Are you saying then that in order for a direct democracy to work well, it has to have some kind of structure, some kind of commonly agreed upon rules that people will unfollow? It can't be just people standing up and giving their opinion and similar to what's going on.
Well, I'm trying. The advantage in there, I think there were a couple of advantages in Botswana. One is the system was had been practiced, you know, as long as people could remember.
Was there a chief?
Well-established runs. There was a chief. The chief spoke first. The chief was generally responsible for governance in the community.
So there was a structure.
There was a kind of structure. But as I say, the decisions, and I was not clear what the issue was. It tended to be criminal cases. So it tended to perform a function like a court, where someone is accused of doing something wrong, and you bring them, and then you decide, in a sense, both questions: did they do anything wrong or not, and what should be done about it to try to resolve that kind of conflict to the satisfaction of the community. The other, if one feature of this is people have done it forever. The other thing I think is that the rules, even though the rules are going to be a little bit vague, they've been the same rules as long as people remember. So there's a general sense there are rules about what you do and what you don't do, and it's a question, you know, how does this fit exactly? It's some of the same questions we get in court, apparently. But is this, you know, did the person break the rule, and how seriously, and what kind of punishments are appropriately levied in this case? But it was operated in a context that was pretty well established. And we tend to think we can change rules. You know, if we don't like this structure, we'll create a different structure. If we don't think this rule is a good rule, we will make a different rule. We have a lot more flexibility than the people in Botswana had. And I think that creates problems for us. But what I'm really getting at, to go back to your question, we're given the example of the Baptist Church is very democratic. I'm thinking that maybe the Lutheran Church is somewhere. There is structure, there are representatives, the representatives do make decisions, so it's somewhere in between.
I think Leonard, but I wouldn't say when you say the Baptists are democratic, rule by the people doesn't say how much it takes to make a decision. I mean, and if you're a majoritarian democracy, that's very different than other forms of democracy. So that if the Baptists, the Southern Baptists, let's say, are democratic, they also, 49% or whatever of their membership are extraordinarily unhappy with the 51% is doing right now.
No, there are, yeah, when you get into talking about direct democracy, there are different ways of doing it. And some may be more like the Botswana model of talking things through until everybody's satisfied, apparently. And others may be more just, we vote and you have more votes than, you know, your side has more votes than our side, your side wins. And if 20% showed up for the meeting, and it was 11% versus 9%, the 11% win. And the 80% who aren't there have no say. And that could be fairly directly democratic.
Were they satisfied with the decision, even though they dissented?
In
Botswana.
In Botswana. Presumably what happens is that you keep talking until you find something that satisfies most people. If you're not satisfied, then you explain why. You try to persuade other people why.
Is this more consensus then?
It is really a consensus building kind of system.
Is it finally a consensus? Then
the descriptions I've seen of it are that it continues until no one has.
So it's like a quicker meeting.
Although I'm told in Quaker meetings that people leave, that there's another device of people leaving or something. You just can't sit, you know, you can't get in and leave.
Or there's the device in a Quaker meeting where the clerk says, I read this as the consensus. Is there an objection? And there, it takes more strength to make an objection than to just disagree.
Mm-hmm.
So you may still be dissatisfied but not going to express
object.
And I suspect that's what happened in book one. But if you think about, well, what happens in other societies is you may have feuds that go on for a very long time, and this is a way of trying to resolve the conflict and avoid any kind of lasting feud, but there still may be bad feelings after, I suspect, after the decision is made.
That's clearly defined consensus. Consensus really means what I think it means. It doesn't mean that I agree with what you're saying, but I can sort of go along with it, and I can adapt to it, and it's probably the best thing all the way around. It doesn't mean I agree, so there's no black and white or right and wrong type of thing.
But it, well, and it strikes me there are either a couple things that can be happening here. One may be I realize that I really value this community more than I care about winning on this issue.
That's what a consensus is.
And the other can be, I think, more of an emotional kind of thing. And it's a question, because emotion in situations that can give rise to feuds, emotions can be highly vested. You can develop very strong feelings about those issues. And so it's, you want to find, you know, reach some kind of resolution where people accommodate that. And where that intense, those intense feelings are adjusted in some way. I've not thought about this, so I'm not sure how that all would work. But it strikes me that's the problem you find in other societies that you're trying to get around, is letting people express things and hoping you reach some resolution of it.
Yes. Wouldn't the trends in management theory encourage, at least in terms of people valuing or consensus building, so that we have the last, I don't know, decade or two more in that direction? So the expectations, maybe in terms of the business world, maybe reflect back in the political world. I don't know. That.
Well, it strikes me, I mean, Larry said this a moment ago about democracy being a very attractive thing that we like to put the label on. And the other side of that is we do tend to think democracy is good. And so we're attracted to things that are democratic. And it seems like we are trying to be democratic in a lot of different arenas of our lives. So several years ago, we took a course in raising your children democratically. The democratic family. There's a democratic workplace. There are, you know, more explicit notions of democracy in the workplace and bringing power to the workers or something, sharing power with workers. There's democratic management or democratic leadership. So the notion of democracy spills over from the political realm into a lot of other realms.
Is there a pattern in all of those examples that you just mentioned and the recent discussion along those lines? I mean, it sounded to me like it was an example of what you gave as a synonym for direct democracy, namely to emphasize participation, to value the active engagement of the various persons. I mean, it was probably less attention to outcome, or maybe even rules, than to involvement. That there was a very high value in all of these.
Well, my sense of, and I don't know this literature, the management literature, my sense is that first there was, I'm not sure what does come first, maybe one of you can help me on this, but there's a thinking that if we give our workers the sense that they're involved in making decisions, that they will be more committed to the job. We will get more productivity out of them. There's a payoff from different organizing work differently.
I think there's a sense of expertise sharing too, much more expertise that the decision raised at least may be examined and might be a better decision.
We are trying to do this at the college where I am, mm-hmm. And the president likes to give the example of some person on the staff who is ordered to go do something, and he says, this will wreck the machine. Not only will it not work, it will wreck the machine if you do this, and the supervisor says, do it anyway. And this fellow apparently got terribly distraught and eventually went to the press and said, I'm being told to do this, and I know if I do this thing which I'm told to do, then it will wreck the machine. And the press says, ah, we need more consultation. Supervisors need to listen to workers. And so there is, yeah, there are several kinds of payoffs assumed to come from that sort of thing. And then it gets to be very difficult to disentangle, is democracy good because democracy is good, introducing it in the workplace good for that reason, or is it good because of payoffs for the company? And along with that, once you start asking that question, you ask the other question, is this real or is it a sham? Are they really sharing power with us, or are they just going through the motions of sharing power through us so we will feel better and work harder and be more satisfied? I don't know where to take that.
Of course, in the companies, if the worker participates some way in stock options or in the profit sharing like that, then it does pay off.
So
increased productivity is good for the company.
You give them a stake that way, and then if you structure the organization so that they have input in the organization as well as having a stake, then both things make sense. This is part of the argument. I wanted to get on the foreign policy. I wasn't terribly concerned about getting here, but I did want to get onto it a little bit. Part of the argument that an economist, Schumpeter, made a long time ago in terms of democracy, that it makes sense to have democracy if the things you can decide, you're affected by that decision, which is what I think you're saying. That if I'm given in the church, if I'm in my local congregation, if I help make a decision as to who's the pastor or whatever, that has immediate consequences for me. And I will be better or worse off as a result. And accordingly, I will inform myself. I will take it seriously, or I may take it seriously and may participate in making the decision because I know that the consequences affect me.
Go ahead, I'm going to finish. I have a question.
It seems like in foreign policy, the things are so remote that it's, all of these problems we've been talking about, the problems of time, problems of number, and this kind of problem of how do the consequences affect me of any kind of decision, and how do I have any input, rise up in doing foreign policy.
You were talking about trends, and I teach high school, and one of the cooperative learning trend.
Yes.
I don't know how many are familiar with that. Are you familiar?
I'm not, no.
You know, it's role-playing, and it's three people working as a group that you put together any combination you want, learning styles, academic, and the rule is I swim, I sink, you sink. And there's three people working together in a group, and here we have a unit on introduction to psychology, and it's maybe a three-week unit, just a small unit, and you know, they have to work on that together. And, you know, they did individual grades and then get group grades. And, you know, is that democratic? And to try, I think we're trying to get the kids to say this is a democratic way for them to interface and to work with one another to achieve something.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of use this word democracy, a freedom type of thing, that you can go where you want to go. I'm just kind of thinking about this.
Okay, yeah. I think we've talked about something similar and call it collaborative learning. But it's the same sort of notion that you want to group students and have them work together and learn something together. And the key is the group grade, that somehow they will be evaluated for how they did as a group. And the assumption is that that's a necessary skill, that to function in the world today, you need to be able to function as a member of groups. And the hope is that they will learn, they will develop those kinds of skills. The problem, I think, is very often you just put the kids in the group. You're a group, you're a group, you're a group. Now go function, and we're going to grade what you produce, and we provide a little direct, I don't know how much direction.
Well, I give learning style. I give them an opportunity to learn their individual learning styles, and then from my information, I try to place them with people that would be either be, sometimes I have conflict ones I deliberately put them together with, as well as ones that are compatible.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also do it with tutor groups, a better student with a lower student, and then there's incentives in here for to interact as a group grade. If everybody gets above a C minus, because I got an F student there, you get rewards, and you have a choice. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, there's no rewards. You just stay where you are.
Isn't this what coaches use to justify athletic programs? Teaching groups to work together, and that's real important.
That's part of what they say.
They say
under the direction of the coach, you do what the coach says.
Yeah. That's a dictatorship.
But they justify our position.
Well, this is the classrooms. Yeah. I am a coach, ex-coach.
I am too.
No, but well, I can. It seems very sensible. I saw several people nod that we do need committees, and people need to learn to work on committees. And this kind of experience can, if I think with proper supervision, can help them develop those sorts of skills. And otherwise, we just fumble along. Some of us doing it fairly well, and some of us doing badly.
And when you put them together and you say create your own government, you'd be surprised what I get.
What do you get?
Boy, the rules are hard, fast, don't step across the line because we're going to nuke you if we do. And there's no negotiation. And I'm saying the number of years that I do this with a project that I have. And I have to put the rule in, no nuking.
Yeah. I think, what age students do you work with?
15, 16 year olds. I'm likely to move into seniors next year, or the past 2 years.
My impression is, and I think it also tends to be true of a lot of college students, is that they can be fairly rigid. You make a rule and that's it. And we stick by that rule. I mean, when it's someone else, it's breaking the rule. The rule is very, very hard and fast.
That's why, when you're talking, wanting to get to foreign policy, I mean, that's why it's so complex. Because, I mean, for all of us, we like the rules we can go by and aren't rules.
Yeah. And that's a problem.
You intervene in Bosnia.
Yeah. I mean, why did you know Somalia?
In Somalia.
Or Sudan.
Yeah.
So much foreign policy does seem to be seat of the pants, or it seems to be, well, we do this in this country, and you say there's other countries like it, but there's a reason why we're not going to be consistent. You know, we are consistent, it's just a different situation.
It's new oil.
Yeah, the new oil, so it's not as critical. By the way, if I can do a little advertising for next week, you're still going to be around next week, I want to take up some of those things next week. I want to talk about Yugoslavia and Somalia next week and look at consistency. Coming back, I'm not sure, I think maybe your question is more profound or more something we can work on better than mine. Do you have a sense? Can we make foreign policy democratically in this more direct way that we've been talking about today? Is there an opportunity for citizen input?
Well, I've been wondering, what's the influence of all these Gallup polls that keep coming into the president? Do they influence them or not?
I heard
it. Does it represent people?
Yeah. It represents, on some level, it does represent people. Certainly there's evidence that some presidents, I heard a paper about Lyndon Johnson and how he was strongly influenced by public opinion polls. Some of the presidents do appear to pay a lot of attention to public opinion polls. On the other hand, he got himself in the bind. He was conducting a war where one chunk of people thought it ought to be expanded and another chunk thought we ought to just walk out of there. And he was in the middle trying to carry it on. So that approach didn't work very well for him. Would you be satisfied with a government that easily responds or readily responds to public opinion?
I mean, foreign policy, traditionally and through the centuries, involves secrecy and to a certain degree, calculations of economic, national self-interest, a whole range of things would be very hard to deal with in terms of direct democracy, especially because it also, foreign policies involve a great deal of negotiation. And if and people cannot sit down, as it were, collectively at the bargaining table and with the people at some other place. So, I mean, we have enough trouble negotiating things among the states here in this country, much less between here in Mexico. Or something like that. I mean, look at the tax thing between Oregon and Washington State right now. For example, you can see that when you go to the bookstore.
Yeah, it, well, it seems offhand that there are a lot of reasons to think that it wouldn't work very well, that it can't work very well. I mean, I'm still perplexed, you know, still fascinated by the question. It seems like in our discussion today that we've said, on the one hand, that there seem to be some practical considerations that would make it difficult to have direct input, and on the other hand, some question about, you're raising another set of practical questions about whether it would work at all. I guess I can elaborate on this, but I'm not sure it's fruitful to elaborate on some of those sorts of problems. We have the alternative, if we don't have a direct democracy, we have a kind of representative democracy. Does that mean that we're satisfied having the president or the members of Congress use their judgment to make foreign policy and either sometimes listen to public opinion or sometimes ignore public opinion? Is that satisfactory?
Don't you think sometimes the public opinion they listen to is a very narrowly focused group that's really hot on an issue? The rest of us are always kind of sitting there hoping our government knows what they're doing, and there's a small group who has a real interest who's putting a lot of pressure, and those are the voices that are heard, and that's scary.
Yeah.
And something which side you're on. The recently in California was the, I just haven't read the paper that. Like 30 million people in California now, when the Zoe Berthe came up for confirmation, Diane Feinstein is going to vote for it. Mm-hmm. The paper reported that she had like 1,500 phone calls, including ours, against it, and 34 in favor. Now, 1,500 people out of 30 million is not a very big number, but that swayed her vote, though, from confirmation to voting.
I guess I'm thinking more in foreign policy, though. We've got constituents in our country.
Domestic examples work.
For constituencies of foreign or of immigrant foreigners, if you will, have a lot of pressure for their own countries, and if they're well organized, they can have an impact far beyond what maybe is rational for the whole country.
And to my mind, it raises a real problem for the decision makers when you're getting a large outpouring. Now, on Zoe Baird, my sense is that happens so spontaneously that, you know, if I'm Feinstein, I know that these are citizens responding. This is a pretty good polling of citizen sentiment. And what you're interested in looking at citizen sentiment is what do they think and how intense are they? And you're getting a sense of real intensity, and it's mostly one way. 99% apparently one way. And that's a very strong kind of message. When there's a chance for a group to orchestrate it, then it is much more difficult. How do people out there really feel? I have a number of students, and this is a domestic issue, but a number of students who are members of the National Rifle Association, but who tell me that, you know, they are members of the NRA, but then they're uncomfortable with what the NRA says on some issues. And how do I, as an elected official, when an issue comes up, the NRA says we have all these members and we'll all vote against you. It must be very difficult to gauge how firm that sentiment is and how much at risk you are. If I vote on this particular piece of legislation, am I going to alienate all these people or not? My sense is we need to be ending things.
One comment, could you help out? I'm a little confused because my first thought was kind of like a lot of other people. It's very complex and it has to be secretive and all that kind of business. On the other hand, as I sat and listened, mm-hmm. there was no question about the fact that we held off in the First World War until the American populace finally came around. We stood there and stood there and stood there. Mm-hmm. Gave covert. We did the same thing in the Second World War until the Japanese finally solved the problem for Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. You know, basically the North Korean invasion brought into the United Nations, and that was a multinational thing. But and Baines Johnson did. I had a an 87% approval rating. It was the highest approval rating of going into any armed conflict in the 20th century. We all did. You bet. And I hire the bastard. I did what he said.
I have some of those.
Don't we in fact follow at least the Gallup poll?
I would say on big decisions, yes, that the presidents are sensitive, and I can't speak for everyone. You've got to distinguish between this one and that one.
I don't know.
But on big issues, they are sensitive. They know there will be repercussions to what they want to do. They know if they're going to get into a major conflict, they better have public support for a major conflict. So public opinion does have some impact. And that's part of what this, let me urge you to come see me again. Part of what I want to talk about later this week, I want to look at four different areas and try to assess what kind of impact the people have on foreign policy in each of those areas. It's not direct democracy, it's not the people assembling and deciding, but there is a kind of impact. The presidents are, you know, they can thumb their nose at it, they can ignore that, they can posture, as I think Reagan sometimes did, and said, I'm not making a decision for political gain, which, of course, looks good, and your popularity goes up. This is a principled person here. But they are sensitive to those sorts of things, right? Some more than